Welcome to Made in Science, the official podcast of the University of Stuttgart. Today our guest is Professor Andrea Barth. She is Professor for Computational Methods of Uncertainty Quantification at the Excellence Cluster for Simulation Technology here at the University of Stuttgart. In our conversation, we will talk about the impact of algorithms on our lives, the role of a principal investigator in research projects, and why it is so important to always have both in life, a plan A and a plan B, just in case. Professor Barth, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
In the area of simulation technology, which is SimTech at the University of Stuttgart, please, could you share with us what the work of the group is about?
So in our group, we look into uncertainty quantification, and we do this with two pretty distinct objects. One is a stochastic partial differential equation, and the other one is a random partial differential equation. When it comes to random partial differential equations, those are equations where, for instance, the input data is uncertain, or the boundary conditions is uncertain, or the equation itself can be uncertain, so the model itself. When it comes to stochastic partial differential equations, we have a stochastic right-hand side, which is most of the time also time-dependent. So that is what we call stochastic forcing. We make this distinction because the mathematical tools to investigate those solutions or the equations itself and their properties are very distinct from each other. So the group is basically working on those equations, their solutions, and then also applications. So we develop fast numerical tools to simulate those equations, to simulate the solutions to those equations, which then make them applicable for applications, in fact. The applications could range from engineering to financial applications, but also in the sciences like physics or chemistry. So the group itself, of course, we as mathematicians, we always work on basic problems, so basic research. We are not really dealing with the application, but we really develop methods. We also show that those equations actually have solutions and what are the properties of the solutions. Sometimes one has to come up with new notions of solutions to specific equations. And yeah, that is basically what we do day in and day out. So we develop new methods, new algorithms, new tools to make the world a better place.
You have just used the word algorithm. How do you define the term?
Well, an algorithm is a method which has a certain input and it delivers a certain output. So it is basically a transformation from an input to an output. And now, of course, the algorithm can have several layers. It can be very complex. It can be very easy. But that is basically an algorithm.
What is the difference between an algorithm and a program?
Well, I would say an algorithm is a little bit more general. So a program is really the implementation of an algorithm. But of course, an algorithm could also mean that you don't implement it. It could be a procedure, right? So it does not necessarily have to be a program. It could be also implemented into a program, but it's not necessary.
In that context, what can algorithms do and what can't they do?
Well, I think every procedural method can be implemented in an algorithm. And of course, then they can deliver you the outcome of a question, or they can calculate the outcome of a question of a well-posed problem. But of course, if your algorithm, if your problem is not well posed, well, then your algorithm is also not going to deliver the outcome. So of course, they have limitations because not every problem is actually solvable with an algorithm. And if it's not solvable with an algorithm, or if we don't find the right algorithm, right, in mass, we could also say that we have just not found yet the solution to the problem at hand. So that could also be the case.
When you have found an algorithm of which you think this works very well, actually, how do you market that algorithm, if you market it at all? After all, as you mentioned earlier, there are a couple of applications possible, such as interest rate calculations, the calculation of traffic flows, or the pricing on the electricity market. So do you reach out? I think you said before, not so much. But how do we find out society? How does society find out about the algorithms and then perhaps can also apply?
Well, as mathematicians, we mainly prove things. So we sit down, we have our problem at hand, which we would like to prove, and then we come up with a proof, or in fact, we say we find the proof. So we always believe that the proof is always there, and we just have not looked into the right direction, or we just haven't found it yet through limitations or so. So I would say we just prove things. Just is probably a little bit of an understatement. And then we develop an algorithm that then actually, based on our proof, can also calculate something. And now it is then on others actually to apply this algorithm to something. I would not say that we market these algorithms or the problems or the solutions to the problems, really, but we just basically write research papers about it. Those research papers hopefully get read by people who apply these algorithms or solutions to their problems. And like this, we contribute to the society and to the mathematical society as well. So I would say that we are not really in a marketing direction here.
In your research, you are a PI, a principal investigator. Can you share with us the many facets of that particular function? What does a principal investigator do?
So in each funding line of the DFG, you have that the funding is structured in a certain way. So in a CRC or in an excellence cluster, you basically have funding for projects, and these projects are then clustered together in what we call project networks. And each PI, but it can also be a PR, which is a principal, so PI is principal investigator and PR is participating researcher, those can apply for funding within these structures. And then it is a question, how is the research structured together? So in SIMTES, in our excellence cluster, we have different project networks. There are overall 8 project networks, and each project network has a different number of PIs and PRs. And as a PI, basically, your role is to apply for the funding, then overlook the funding, and also, of course, hopefully write a successful new proposal. So that is what PIs, but also PRs do. So in general, it's just a structural element of the DFG, let's say. But of course, within SIMTES, we also have that the different project networks have spokespersons. And I'm actually one of the spokespersons for, in this case, PN5. So as a spokesperson of PN5, I'm responsible for organizing the research within this project network. So I organize meetings, so we have bi-weekly meetings where we discuss in the project itself, or like how we can help each other. It's basically very interdisciplinary, our discussions. So we have PIs from math and we have PIs from computer science, but also engineers. And we just talk about basically how to solve each other's problems and how can we help each other. So that is one thing that we do, but it's also that, of course, we have to do reporting for the funding we get. So that is also what a PI basically does. So you request the funding, but then you, of course, also have to do the reporting. And, of course, right now, as I guess big parts of the German academia in the process of the new excellence strategy. So we're right now writing the new proposal for the extension of the SimTech cluster.
SimTech here at our university has been very, very successful. What do you think is that particular SimTech formula, if I can call it that, here at the University of Stuttgart? And if there is one that you see, does it differ from how simulation technology is defined and practiced at other places of higher education? After all, you were also for some time abroad at the University of Oslo and also at ETH Zurich. How and how far is Stuttgart special and different?
Well, I would say it is special in the sense that I have the feeling here the interdisciplinarity or transdisciplinarity is much more lived than in other places. And this is clearly enhanced by the excellence cluster. So SimTech plays a fundamental role in the interdisciplinary exchange in the university, I would say. In other places, of course, you also have interdisciplinary projects, but it is not so structured as we have it in SimTech, and that over such a long time with so many different subjects also being present, right? So we have from math to computer science to engineers to physicists to chemists, right? We have actually we encompass quite a broad number of topics of the whole university, and that is something I would say that is very rare. And especially, I guess, of course, worldwide, I guess you can find other places which have similar structures. But I would say within Germany, that's very unique.
Now, on top of that, SimTech is also very international. How important is that aspect for the work you do with your group? And where do you allocate the international researchers that you work with?
Well, of course, you have an excellence cluster, so you'd want to do excellent research. And for excellent research, you need the best people. And of course, you recruit internationally for that. It is also, I would say, you know, the German system can be quite German. And I would say that we in SimTech did our best or tried to do our best to have also the university structure being very international. So what, for instance, what we do is that our meetings of the principal investigator are held in English. And I think that is not normal, like usually the university meetings are held in German because the legal language of the university is German, and therefore also those meetings have to be by law in German. But in SimTech, we basically stroke a little deal that we can have them in English. So basically, that is a first step of welcoming international guests or international researchers much more into the system than it is in a normal faculty the case. And of course, one also has to say that we managed with SimTech something very unique in Germany, that we basically requested the law to be changed for us. So before, it was not possible that an excellence cluster could be something like a faculty or a faculty-like structure. And in fact, the government changed the law in a way that we have SimTech now not only as an excellence cluster, but we have a certain structure which is faculty-like, and this represents SimTech as well. So Of course, within this structure, we have a lot more possibilities to welcome also international researchers, much more than it is just by the excellence cluster itself.
And let's stay with international for a moment. And perhaps also, I'm asking at this moment for your advice. How does a future doctoral student make contact to find a doctoral advisor, especially if that doctoral student is from abroad? I'm also asking because at international education fairs, when I represent the university, that is one of the most asked questions by prospective doctoral students. What do you recommend for someone from abroad who is looking to find a doctoral advisor here at ZIMTEC or also beyond at the University of Stuttgart?
So first, I would say that you should really look into the people, into the subjects, and then you should really single out with whom you would like to work. That's the first task you should do if you're interested, because the more knowledge you have about this, the better it is. And then I think it would be a good idea to get into touch, like we have, of course, in the university now a tool where you can apply centrally. That would be one way. Or you get in touch directly with the professor. It's always better to get in touch directly, like in person. So it would be good to do this in sort of like a conference or something like this than just via email. Because via email, it's always a little bit more tricky, I would say. So that would be the first step. So that one gets to know each other a little bit and to get to know the research of each other. And then I guess something like a relationship could be established. But of course, I also understand that that is not an easy task. And I can also understand that this is a big topic. And I would not say that there's a clear path. I think you should really try to get to conferences, to get to meet people, because that is usually a lot better of a way to really get into the position.
And now talking about the biggest group, the students that you work with, I wonder, these days, with all the technical possibilities, have you noticed any change in the attitudes of students, say, towards methods of uncertainty quantifications, your area? Are they more willing, are the students more willing these days to become involved in simulations? Or has this been really something very stable over years and now, by chance or not, the technological possibilities have just been enhanced, so there is more of a possibility that students can work with, but that would be about all, or is there more?
Well, I think nowadays students are a lot more willing to engage also with interdisciplinary science. And that is basically what uncertainty quantification is. So we are in between the fields of numerics and stochastics. And before, I think students had much more of a clear idea, well, I'm doing algebra or I'm doing numerics or I'm doing analysis, and now a lot more people are interested in the, it's interdisciplinary within math. So I think that is really what has changed. And what has also changed quite a bit is that our students are a lot better in coding. So that makes, of course, simulations a lot easier. They're a lot more interested in the application, especially when you look at the development of neural networks and AIs. So that is the big topics for the students. And I think especially with uncertainty quantification, we fit very well into this and also into applications, into possible applications. And I think that has changed quite a bit. Now, of course, one always has quite some competition within math, so there are also very different areas where the people are interested in. So I would say that I have a steady flow of students coming in, I always had, being in the middle between two different subjects, I could grab students from both directions. So I could have students from numerics and I could have students from stochastics. And I think that was always a little bit of an advantage, and that has not changed, I would say.
You yourself were a PhD student at one point, and now you educate PhD students. Would you say that the way you were taught back then has influenced your way of teaching? Are there any things that you do or don't do as a consequence in the doctoral education as you practice it?
Well, I was a doctoral student, as you already mentioned, in the University of Oslo, actually in something that was called the CMA, the Center for Math and Application. It was also an excellence center. And the Nordic system is quite different from the German system, for instance. So in the Nordic system, you don't really have an advisor, a direct advisor. You, of course, have people you work with, but there's nobody who's really telling you what to do. So it is a very different system. So I think I still have quite some of that in me. So that carried over on how I actually look after my PhD students. But of course, I'm also now in a German system, so of course I'm actually looking more over them than I guess it's usually the case in for instance, Norway. But what I actually do different from my times as a PhD student is that I organize weekly meetings. So we have what we call the UQ seminar, which is a weekly seminar where we meet the whole afternoon and discuss each other's problems and try to solve them, or at least try to give hints on what to do next. And so that is clearly different from my times as a PhD student. I didn't have those meetings or any of that type. But I think it is really helpful for the students because they are not left alone. They see a lot that the other people also have problems. It's a lot better to solve problems together than alone. So they progress very differently, I have the feeling. And of course, the big advantage of this is that we also call it the cake seminar. So we have a random generator who is basically telling us who has to bring cake the next week. And the great thing about this is that the cake always has to be baked personally. So we are not allowed to buy cakes. So on top of this, I learn a lot about baking, which is also great, to be honest.
In 2013, you became first a junior professor, and since then have also become in 2017 a full professor at SimTech. When did you know that you were heading in the right professional direction?
Well, I think an academic career is never really plannable. So I think until you are a professor, you don't really plan it. Or I guess some people do, but I think the big chunk is actually not really planning on becoming a professor ever. So I was a postdoc in ETH, and I really liked the work. I had a great time in ETH. It was a very, very nice group. Good progress. I had my own research agenda, which I pushed and I really liked. And then the position within SimTech popped up and I applied for it and I got it and I was really, really happy. But of course, back then, this was not a tenure track position, so I didn't have a tenure track option on my junior professorship. And that, of course, made it a little bit more complicated. So, of course, I knew that after 6 years, that would be basically over if I wouldn't find anything else. And of course, that makes it a little bit less plannable. So of course, I actually had in my mind, well, I probably have to look for something else. So because you cannot know that you will get a professorship. So of course, I would not I would not say that I never thought that I would get a professorship, but there was really the possibility that I wouldn't. So, of course, I planned with something else as well. So only when I actually got finally the appointment, I was sure that I would be a professor or that I could stay a professor. But until then, I actually did not really have it in my clear or have it as a clear career path.
You have just told us about the uncertainties on your path at SimTech, becoming a full professor. And you also indicated that there was this idea on your mind, back in your mind, perhaps I got to have another solution if something doesn't work out. Let's call it Plan A and Plan B in life. Why is it important to have both plans, Plan A and Plan B, always ready? Is this a general principle of yours?
Yes, it is a general principle, I would say. I'm a very positive thinking person in general, and I think it is important that one really has structures their preferences and their dislikes very well. So, and from this you can then deduct plans. And of course, my plan A was always to become a professor here. But, well, there was of course a chance that it wouldn't work out, and then you cannot just go about with no other plans, right? Like, at least I could not. I guess some people can, but I cannot. So I of course had to have a different plan. Now, as a mathematician, you can work in many fields. So when I was a junior professor, after 3 years, you get evaluated, which means that you basically get your habilitation. And my plan was, okay, after I have this habilitation, and I don't have yet the option of a full professorship and an unlimited contract, I would look for something else, because I would not wait until the last day of this contract to look for another option. So I was just thinking, like, okay, after the evaluation, that in the next semester break I would prepare for interviews to apply in the industry. And luckily, shortly before that, I got the appointment to a different position. So that basically was it then for my plan A and plan B. But I think I learned to always have a plan A and a plan B. From my hobby, that is climbing or bouldering, in fact. And I have been doing it all my life. And so if you're bouldering and you see a problem, doesn't matter if it's indoors or outdoors, you have to come up with a plan. So you have a plan of how to climb it, of how to solve the problem, I would actually call it. But sometimes while you climb, you realize that it will not work out the way you planned. So you also there always have to have a plan B. Or it's just good to have one, because you might have to intuitively change something along the way. And I think this is where I actually learned to think like this, and I think I can actually apply it for everything in life. I always have a plan A and a plan B, even if I go to the supermarket.
We are very glad that you made your plan A today to be with us and didn't have to follow with whatever plan B would be. Let's look ahead a little bit into the future. Do you think, with all the data around, that today we are heading into a period of less uncertainty? There is more material that needs to be addressed with calculations and results. But as I said, there are also more numbers and facts around to calculate. Does this make the outcome, the result, the more visible, more certain, or really more uncertain?
I don't think you can say that it's more certain or uncertain. So some things have become more certain. So if you look, for instance, at the weather forecast. So a couple of years ago, we shot some satellite into orbit, and those satellites actually make the weather forecast a lot more reliable. Now, of course, if you look at your weather forecast, you will still see there that there is a rain probability of 70%. So it is not that it is less, it will still not tell you that it's going to rain or it's not going to rain. There's still a probability. So there is, of course, more data, but the problems also become more complex. So when you look for your weather forecast, for instance, the models with which a weather forecast is calculated have become more involved since then. Of course, you have more data, but you also have bigger computers which can handle better algorithms, which can handle then the solution of more complex problems. And I think it goes hand in hand. So the calculation methods become more involved. We can calculate better solutions to more complex problems. And therefore, I would say that the uncertainty quantification gets more precise. But it is not necessarily smaller. So it is, we live in a more precisely calculated world, but that also means that we have probably more parameters which we have to account for, and the equations become a lot more involved, and that makes then the solution a lot more uncertain again. So I would say it goes hand in hand, more complex problems, more data, but then also just a better uncertainty quantification, and not a, I would not say that the uncertainty gets less.
In that context, what does that mean for SimTech, and perhaps for yourself and your work as well? If there is such a complex situation, will you specify in a particular way, in a particular area? Is that one of the approaches you take, or would you say, no, we have to grow, we have to be bigger at SimTech, we have to invest in certain technologies and ways of teaching and in our research also? Do you have to be even more connected to other centers in the world than you are already? I think I'm asking, which path are you on?
So SimTech is going to develop in a more data-integrated direction even further. So that was already our last proposal. It was data-integrated simulation science, which basically means that we also incorporate a lot of AI or neural networks as a method of approximating solutions or part of the solution. And I think that is where we basically also will go on, in the direction of data integration into simulation science. I think that is something quite unique within Germany and also in the world. Of course, you have here and there centers who do also similar subjects, but I think our specialty is that we apply those to engineering problems in a big scale. And this is also where we're going to, of course, it's not that we have solved all these problems in the last 7 years, so there's still, of course, a lot to do, and of course, always when you solve one problem, the next 10 pop up, so we will never run out of problems, and I think that is where the future is still heading. Probably I could say that in the next funding phase, maybe the problems become a lot more detailed, I would say, so a lot more specific in some cases than to the previous funding phases.
Towards the end of our conversation, we always come to a particular question and answer session called Moment 7. selected 7 questions that we would like you to answer as shortly as possible. We call these questions not questions, but moments. Moment 1. Spätzle or Maultaschen?
This is a very tough one for me because I think I would go for Spätzle, but I'm actually a huge pasta fan, so I would not classify Spätzle as pasta, but definitely, because I'm also vegetarian, definitely more Spätzle than Maultaschen.
Moment 2. Certainty or uncertainty?
Well, clearly uncertainty, right? Like, that's clear, otherwise I'm out of my job.
Moment 3. Do you have a media recommendation for us, a book, a music, a movie you think we should know about?
I just read a book which was called Infinite Powers by Stephen Strogatz, I think he was called. And there was a very interesting concept in that book where he explains how Archimedes calculated the area under parabola or of a fraction of a parabola. And he made this comparison. Of course, we don't know if it's actually really true, but he said that basically Archimedes weighted his approach. So he basically saw his approach as a weighting in his mind of the solution concept. And I found this as a mathematician really fascinating, how he explained this and how he did this. This was an amazing story. I hope it's true. I don't know if it's true, but I just would love that it would be true. But I mean, if I actually had to recommend one book, it would be my favorite book, and that would be Cien Años de Soledad by Gabriel García Márquez.
Moment 4. The best advice that you have ever received was?
A problem well stated is a problem half solved. I think that's actually true, especially for a mathematician.
Moment 5. Your favorite place at the University of Stuttgart?
I don't know if it actually still belongs to the university, but I love this Bärensee, which is close to Vaihingen. So I always run around there, and this is lovely.
Moment 6. If I could start all over again, I would do the following differently.
I would do everything precisely like I did it.
And moment 7. Please complete the sentence. Thanks to my studies, I know that...
I don't know anything.
Thank you for our conversation. And most of all, wishing you all the best for your future work in uncertainties here at the University of Stuttgart, in your international team or with your international team, and in this very interdisciplinary fashion that you celebrated and pointed out so well for us. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to our audience, please stay tuned for our next conversations that are always based on what is made in science. My name is Wolfgang Holtkamp. Have a great podcasting day. Goodbye and good talking.